article about the implications of the Phoenix Light sightings to the inaugural issue of Open Minds magazine. Lowe also has a personal website with many wonderful articles and UFO news at www.larrylowe.com/UFO_news. And UFO needs to be in capital letters, and N in news needs to be capitalized as well. He is also a fellow Arizona resident, and I'm very pleased to welcome Larry to the program. And welcome, Larry.
Dee, thank you very much for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, well, I'm tickled to death. You know, David and I have done quite a bit of looking into the Phoenix Lights incidents, and it does get kind of confusing with some of the videos that's out there, you know, on this particular event, such as, you know, the one that you see a lot, that it can get confusing on whether that's the Phoenix Lights or flares. You know, and
well,
I think
the video you're referring to was shot by Mike Kristen up in North Phoenix from his home, and he shot over the Sierra Estrella Mountains. And I was recently out there to talk to him, and among other things, I got a good firsthand account of that video, how it was shot, got to see the original version tape played. And I also ascertained with my model that the what's called the North Tack section of the Barry Goldwater Gunnery Range is in fact directly behind the mountain range that is out there somewhere in the dark on that film. And the question that has haunted everyone for over a decade is, are the lights that appear in an arc and appear to be motionless, are they on this side of that Estrella mountain range, or are they on the far side? If they're on the far side, that would imply that they're on the gunnery range. They could well be flares. I think the sad part of all of this is that this now iconic bit of video, which has come to stand for the Phoenix Lights, is really largely a distraction from the much more significant events that went on all over the state that night, which I'm sure you and probably your listeners are well aware of.
Exactly. You know, usually I start off with my first question is being, how did you personally get involved in the UFO subject?
Well, that's an interesting question to try to answer. I can remember being about 14, 12 or 14, and I came across a copy of Edward J. Ruppelt's book, which by then was in paperback, called Report on Unidentified Flying Objects. And I devoured that, and it set me to thinking, because I grew up in a world and in a reality that was explained to me that was very concise. It was middle America. I was born in Wyoming. Dwight Eisenhower was president. Father knew best. Everything was good and fine and comfy, and there was no such thing as aliens to be considered. And when I read Ruppelt's book, it really made me stop and think, wow, something is going on. And then I sort of laid the subject down for a good long period of time. And in the middle 80s, a colleague, when I was working in Los Angeles for an interactive design firm, a colleague made a comment that made me wonder more about the issue again, and I went down to a local UFO conference, and I began to listen to some of the speakers, and I began to read books, and I joined a local MUFON chapter, and I began to attend meetings. And the more books I read, and the more people I talked to, and the more I learned, the more questions there were. I don't know if that's an answer to your question or not.
I can relate with being first introduced to the subject by reading a book. I was 10 and read Frank Edwards' Flying Saucer Serious Business.
That was one of the classics.
Yeah. How did you get... Oh, wait, let me back up. Can you explain the Examiner deal, how that all got started.
Well, a colleague of mine, Rebecca Hardcastle, who is active in the exopolitics movement and also founded the concept of exoconsciousness, as my interest here locally in UFOs revived in the last couple of years, she got me on the exopolitics mailing list as a monitor only, and I began to read the discussions going on amongst the people that are trying to make UFOs and the issue of disclosure a responsible matter of political discourse, which at this point it's kind of like the electric third rail that will kill you of politics. Nobody wants to even talk about the issue. And on that list, Jeff Peckman, who is a city councilman, I believe, at this point he's a political activist in Denver, was casting about for ways to bring the issue of UFO awareness to the public. Now, Jeff has got an interesting take on politics, and that is, if the government and the legislature will not enact the laws that you'd like, there is a mechanism for the public to take the law into their own hands, or create the creation of law into their own hands, and it's called the public initiative. And he opened up an initiative in Denver saying that that would be voted on and put on the ballot, asking for the city to create a Department of Extraterrestrial Affairs. This is not unlike what Rebecca Hardcastle and her team were doing here in Phoenix for a national version of the same thing. Well, Peckman became aware of the Examiner.com, which is a mechanism that is a giant national web application that has a magazine, it's actually a newspaper metaphor, and individuals in the local areas can pick an area of expertise, and if they pass a certain test in terms of the writing ability and a commitment to perform, they can become an examiner in their area. And Peckman was urging everybody on the list to sort of join hands and take the media into their own hands in the same way in the political world he was trying to get to taking lawmaking hands. And long story now, finally short, I followed Jeff Peckman's lead and joined up as the Phoenix UFO Examiner.
That's interesting. And so that's how you got your position for the Examiner. That's cool. And what's your main focus of your position of the UFO topic for the Examiner?
Well, there's multiple facets. I'm the Phoenix UFO Examiner, so I do try to keep a bit of an eye on the local UFO scene, try to keep everybody aware of the activities of the local Maricopa County section of Mutual UFO Network, run by Jim and Stacy, who do a very good job. So a little bit of my activities are to publicize the local UFO activities. Lynn Katai, for example, has a screening of her documentary. We make sure that that gets a little play. But part of the real goal of a nationwide network of examiners is to work together to write articles that will get widespread reading and maybe crack through the truth embargo that the mainstream media tends to have on these issues. And so sometimes I write articles that are very broad, very mainstream in nature, in order to get people to consider maybe a wider reality than the mainstream media is about to give them.
I like that. Because so many times in media, be it print or television, radio, When the UFO subject is brought up, there's a lot of the giggle factor there. We need people out there to help get rid of that.
That's very much the case. And I think what we've got, particularly I've noticed recently in the Phoenix Lights case, and just to back up a little bit, because I am the Phoenix UFO Examiner, one of the things that has come to the obvious attention is one of the most significant UFO mass sightings of the modern era occurred in this town little more than a decade ago, and so I've begun an investigation back into that to try to understand it better for myself, and in the due process I will document it. But there is a giggle factor. There is a reluctance on the part particularly witnesses who have the most amount of credibility tend to have the most amount to lose. So they tend to be the most anonymous and the least willing to come forward. So the examiner wants to put forward a point of view that this is serious, reasonable, responsible journalism, and this is serious, reasonable, responsible news. Roger Marsh happens to be the national UFO examiner. He does an excellent job simply by taking the UFO reports that come in to MUFON on a steady basis, transcribe them, add a picture, do a bit of analysis, format them, and publish them. And he's got an inexhaustible supply of news material because there's enough news of UFO reports in this country to keep his and probably half a dozen other columns going full tilt.
This is true. Like just recently, I believe it was around May 8th or so, something was cited that was seen from Sedona all the way into the Phoenix Valley, and now NASA saying, oh, it was just a balloon we sent up to study gamma rays, or cosmic rays, or one of the two. And even the way the local news, or TV news anyway, handled it was, again, a bit of the giggle factor.
That's a very interesting event. It's a textbook case of how the local MUFON organization is supposed to work. Jim Mann wrote an email to a number of us, and it was in fact a 400-foot high-altitude research balloon launched from New Mexico early in the morning to carry a gamma ray observatory. It's one of these things that when you see it on the ground, it looks like a limp plastic bag with a little bubble in it, but by the time it gets to 130,000 feet, the air is so thin that that gas is expanded to turn the thing into a complete sphere, and it's somewhat translucent. And as it turned out, it was seen in the morning to the east of Phoenix area, backlit by the sun as a large glowing dot in the east. It was photographed in Scottsdale. It was photographed in Sedona, and it was witnessed in Scottsdale. And then later in the day, as it drifted overhead at altitude to the west, it was backlit by the sun and became highly apparent to a lot of people driving home. And before the storm set in that night, there was an awful lot of phone calls in. However, the news media did have a tendency to somehow connect the fact that one of the first reports was phoned in by some folks up in Scottsdale, or in Sedona, that run a UFO shop. It made it almost seem as if they were jumping to conclusions, which is not entirely fair, because in Sedona you get an awful lot of instances of what we call orb phenomenon. And from their experience and their context of the way they were looking at things, it was sort of reasonable for them to wonder about it. And what you needed to do was the kind of research that MUFON does to put all the pieces together to actually know what the thing is.
True. This is true. I get so upset when I hear reporters laughing over the subject. It just irritates me to no end. They claim to be objective, but that doesn't always happen.
Somehow I think objectivity has gone out the window in American journalism a long time ago. The news tends to seem to be less about the really critically important issues of our time and more about the activities of celebrities or whatnot that will get good ratings. And for some reason, a lot of the media tend to think that a good, solid, juicy UFO report that can be quickly debunked as something else is a perfect little puff piece to put at the end and then
Yeah, I agree. excuse me. The project that you've got going with the geostadial animation project you've got going.
Yes.
You know, you gave me a sneak peek at that, and wow. I mean, gosh, I can't imagine how many hours you have put in so far on that. That is just an amazing bit of work.
Well, thank you very much. As I said, I got out of the UFO investigation issue for nearly a decade when I returned here from Los Angeles and really wasn't very interested in solving what I considered an intractable problem. And I had not paid a lot of attention to the Phoenix Lights when they first occurred. I was in Los Angeles at the time and working in the UFO field with MUFON LA. They called me down to the studio in a big rush and said, we've got video of an alien spacecraft and you need to tell us that this is what it is so we can tell our listeners. And I came in and I saw the Mike Kristen film and I told them that from my moments of analysis that looked to me like some bright dots in a dark sky, and I wasn't prepared to explain what it was without further analysis. And so that was my sum total of involvement on the day of the event went down. I attended a meeting, a screening of Lynn Katai's documentary at the Harkins Theater a couple of years ago now at the invitation of a friend of mine. And in the middle of her documentary, about 10 seconds of animation caught my eye. And it was done a piece of work that was done by Michael Channer and his son based on a lot of reports that had flooded into Village Labs at the time. And simply put, there were so many reports of unusual craft or arrays of lights from various people at various times around the valley that they simply resorted to getting out a map and push pins and saying, okay, where was this one? What time was it? What did they say it looked like? When they got done, a picture began to evolve of a large-scale aerial operation of some indeterminate nature. And that that information was reduced to an animation that Tanner created. There was a lot of work, animation work, done at video at Village Labs. This was actually just sort of a crude thing. But it showed all of the objects moving at different times in different directions in chronological order, and it just struck me that until we build a model that lets us see, and from any vantage point, what went on that night across space and across time, no one's going to have an idea what really occurred, and we will spend the rest of our lives wondering whether or not those lights that Mike Kristen took a video of were flares or not. So I set out to take Google Earth, which, as you know, is a commonly available geospatial analysis system. If you get a sufficiently powerful computer and a web connection, the world literally is on your desktop. And Michael Tanner was nice enough to provide me with some starting information. And we began to do some 3D modeling, and we began to put the craft where the witness reports said they were, and we begin to relate those by lines of path to say, well, if this kind of object was seen here and it was seen 10 minutes later over there going the same direction, chances are that was the same thing. And pretty soon I had a half a dozen lines drawn across the Phoenix Valley of different flight paths, of different kinds of craft at different times, which is an altogether remarkable different bit of business than just some light. Unfortunately, we didn't get a lot of video of the large reported craft, and such video as we've gotten, some of which has disappeared under exceedingly mysterious circumstances. So if we can recreate that night with Google Earth, we can give people a picture as to what went on. Then, of course, the corollary is if you could do that, you could probably give the entire, you know, nation a much better picture of what's going on around the nation, because the Phoenix Lights is like a 5-minute trailer to a 2-hour action-packed blockbuster movie. It's but a taste of the UFO activity that is reported in this country on a yearly basis.
It's interesting. You know, I've recently been reading about the Hudson Valley sightings, and I got to thinking, boy, if somebody could do the same thing with that particular area, they'd have that whole area of New York completely covered.
I couldn't agree more, and I think that one of the salient points that one of the lines we need to draw between a couple of dots on the UFO mystery map is the line that goes between Phoenix and the Hudson Valley. And it takes a dogleg and goes by Stevensville, and then it cuts back and goes to Lubbock. And probably when we're all done drawing it, it is all over the place, because the large wings have been seen in lots of places. But the Hudson Valley in the late 80s, for about 4 or 5 years, was, I don't know, awash with steady reports of these big, mysterious, silent, black, floating objects, sometimes well lit, sometimes partially lit, going over people at a relatively low altitude, completely silent, and changing people's lives who observe them. When you're face to face with a real witness, there's no doubt in your mind that the individual who is telling you the report believes wholeheartedly he saw what he saw. There just isn't any question whatsoever in their mind. And that Hudson Valley went on for a matter of years. Phoenix was just one long night in March.
Well, I think we could extend that line, too, from the Phoenix area to the Northwest, because wasn't there reports that, you know, on March 13th, 97, of this object first being sighted, over Henderson, Nevada, which is just outside of Las Vegas?
Henderson is, in fact, just south of Las Vegas. Excuse me, it's on the way towards Hoover Dam. And 5 lights were seen in formation, quite in a little bit of a V formation. I think it was around 5:30, headed to the southeast, past Kingman, and arrived in the Prescott Valley. Those set of lights traced an entire path down through Prescott Valley, down through the valley between I-17, down through the Phoenix Valley, down the highway to Tucson, and were last reported as such, as best we can figure out. That particular formation was last reported to split up somewhere near Oracle. So the Phoenix Lights probably would best be characterized as the Great Arizona Mass Sighting of 1997. But Phoenix Lights has become the popular name.
Yeah, it's I'm like you. I kind of like hate using the term the Phoenix Lights, you know, because there was more than just lights that were sighted that night. There were triangles. There were V's or boomerangs, whichever term you want to use to describe them. Disc shapes. Little balls of light being dropped from one of the craft. It was a whole mishmash of different configurations, I guess you could say, of objects.
I get some considerable heat from my colleagues in the community when I use the term air show. But for me, it has a particular meaning, because I was, for a number of years, the director of the San Diego National Air Festival in San Diego. And from an operational point of view, an air show is a very specifically planned event using dissimilar aircraft, flown by experts to a precision pattern over a specific geographic area for a specific effect upon a group of people who happen to be watching. And that general definition applies to what went on March 13, 1997. There were all kinds of different craft involved, reported, I've got to be very careful to say, reported, observed, witnessed, in various places in the valley. Orbs, as you say, the lights were seen in some cases to detach from the larger, apparently structured craft, go down and operate on their own, and then rejoin later on. All of this activity went on inside the airspace of what I think is the fifth, or was at the time, the fifth busiest airspace in the country. None of these aircraft had transponders. I don't imagine that they had an N number. None of them were in contact with air traffic control, and yet there wasn't any conflict with any air traffic that went on that night, other than a few cases that are in their own way remarkable. There was a Cessna, twin Cessna 400, I think a 421, going over Chino Valley, I believe it was. And they actually had one of the large, reported one of the large craft, structured craft, go underneath them. And their first impression was that, to give one a sense of the size of the object, that the lights were going out. There was an electrical failure in the whole county because the lights were going out of the whole town underneath them as they flew over it. And it was only when it got far enough along they realized that there was a sharp edge involved, and in fact something enormous was passing between them and the ground. There's a number of reports like that. Pilot was coming into Prescott Airport, and there's also a report of an Air West, not Air West, America West flight out of Phoenix that saw something go overhead at 20,000 feet, and then they could only see three of the five sets of lights on it. So whatever happened involved a penetration of some of the busiest airspace in America by an unknown number of very large objects, and they didn't interfere with anything. And if that's not precision planning and up-to-the-minute execution, I don't know what is.
Oh, I agree. I'm the section on your geospatial. Section of we're talking about the V-shaped object.
Right.
One of the people on the ground said they saw, I believe it was a 737 flying above this object, and they were very familiar with the way the commercial planes coming into Sky Harbor maneuver over their area of where they live. And found out that the aircraft there are approximately 12,000 feet in altitude.
I believe that number would be closer to 1,200 feet. 12,000.
Oh, you're right. Excuse me, 1,200. You're right.
Go ahead.
Oh, and that this object was well below that 1,200 feet.
One of the problems I had when I went to go and build this model of the event was that I was reluctant to place the objects as low and as close to the ground as they were reported. I'm a commercial pilot, and I value my license, and there's an FAR called Part 91 Flight Regulations, and Part 91.9 is Careless and Reckless Flying. And if you go flying along at the altitude that these objects flew, in a 172 or a Bonanza or something, and if you, and anyone got your N number, you would probably be in violation of Part 91.9. Mike Fortson is the witness I believe you're talking about, who saw a large, gigantic V-shaped craft approaching his position in Chandler traffic to Sky Harbor, and he specifically saw it go underneath an airliner that was on downwind. That airliner was going over to the east to make a couple left-hand turns and line up to land going to the west. And his estimation of the size of that craft, which you have to give a little bit of variation to, given that it was late at night and we don't know what we're looking at and there's not much reference, but he thought it was on the order of a mile wingspan. Anything a mile wingspan that was going 300 feet above the treetops, it's just difficult to comprehend how that could be done.
Well, again, referring back to the Hudson Valley deal, oh gosh, there were hundreds of people that were seeing that what they were seeing was only 200 to 300 feet above the treetop.
Exactly.
Yeah, and they were describing these as very large, triangular to be your boomerang-shaped objects flying that low, at very, very slow speed.
What's remarkable about this is that there is a consistency. There's almost a taxonomy that you can produce of the reports. And there's been V-wings recently reported in New Jersey. There's been V-wings reported in Indianapolis and in Illinois. In fact, I think they're having a UFO conference this weekend to try to address that. There's been a lot of triangles reported in the Midwest. Now, oddly enough, a number of those seem to be in the general vicinity of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. So I don't know what to make of that.
Oh, I haven't heard that.
Yes, there's been triangles reported in the Midwest. There, in fact, I released an Examiner report earlier this year about that. I went into the fact that the Phoenix Lights bear such a tremendous similarity to the Hudson Valley sightings. And if you look into the historical record, you can realize that there is a similarity to what was seen at Lubbock. Only Lubbock was a very short-lived phenomenon. The night that I wrapped up my Examiner report, there was a sighting in Salt Lake City of a very large V-shaped object flying low over the freeway, followed by a number of much smaller, much faster black triangles.
I'm going to have to do some more digging and read up on more recent sightings.
I actually did a news flash at the end of my piece because I couldn't stand it. It just seemed fateful somehow that I no more than got that piece posted and I looked around at the other examiners and Roger Marsh had gone into some detail about the Salt Lake City site. So the really valuable aspect of the Phoenix Lights sighting events, when you begin to understand all that went on that night, is that they represent the rest of the country. And when you take the rest of the reports of these kinds of crafts that are going on, that's when I think the light bulb begins to go on. Just as the fact that you cannot take the Roswell crash or the downing of the Roswell disk, depending upon how you want to characterize it, in and of itself, it seems to be this little anomaly. One wonders why one poor little flying saucer wandering around loose in the universe would happen to hit the ground somewhere near Doe Place, New Mexico. It seems a little bit odd, but the critical thing to do is take these reports in context, and the first report of 1947, 50 years before 1997, by the way, was in Virginia of a weatherman who was tracking a weather balloon with his little telescope that they tracked them with, and when a silver disc-shaped object flitted through his vision, and so he used his telescope to track it a little bit, and it was going at an enormous speed, and it was headed from east to west. It's kind of ironic that the first first observation was actually of a weather balloon by a weather observer seeing, obviously not a weather balloon flying through his field of vision. If you follow the reports in the spring of 1947, you'll see a trail of sightings that goes across the northern tier of states, at which point an airliner going into Idaho sees several lights or disc-shaped objects, DC-4, I think it was. Shortly after that, a fellow by the name of Kenneth Arnold, flying a call air in the mountains out of Idaho, headed to Washington, witnessed 9 of these craft. He, of course, landed and tried to report them to the FAA, and in the process of talking to reporters, the term flying saucers was coined. It became national news, and there was an array of disc-shaped object sightings going all the way around Seattle, where the Boeing Aircraft Company was building airplanes like the B-29 at the time, and down the West Coast, Sacramento, Edwards Air Force Base, where there was a lot of testing going on. Ultimately, then on about, I think, the 4th of July, a gentleman by the name of Rhodes took a photograph right here in Phoenix of something that looks a little bit like the heel of a shoe, saucer-shaped with a little flares on the end. And then 2 days later, the objects start to be seen all over New Mexico, and the Roswell events occur, and that then becomes history. Suddenly, the Roswell crash makes some sense. We were being observed by some sort of unknown technology, and it wanted to look around, and it got as far as our most sensitive base before something happened, and one or two of them hit the ground.
That's cool. Excuse me. Yeah, around that time there was also quite a bit of sightings in the Boise area and off towards Twin Falls, Idaho. I used to live in Idaho, so that's I'm pretty familiar with the UFO lore of the area. I used to work in Boise. I have another quick question here in relation to the light. In your opinion, what are the key aspects of the Phoenix Lights case?
Well, there's several aspects that I think, I mean, we can kind of get lost in details. But there's several things that don't. I mean, one of the things we talked about is that they'd be better named if they were the Arizona mass sightings. Another thing I've touched on is that the only public visible evidence, which is Mike Christen's enigmatic video, is in fact a distraction because it kind of focuses on that one aspect when there's a much larger set of reports to be considered. There's a particular effect that is noted by observers of who report large craft at close range. They say the craft were silent going over, but there's something even more, a little more interesting than that. The ambient noise of the neighborhood, the dogs barking, the whine of the city in the background, the music from someone's house down the street or whatever, all of that sound goes away at the point where whatever this object is passes over closest. So there's some kind of interesting field dampening effect going on. The observers tend to report a kind of timelessness, a sort of a fixation, and that's easily explainable because of the size of the phenomenon. But they get looking at something and they can't quite take their eyes off it. It's almost as if time stops for a moment. There's other activities that go on with the witnesses that we tend to not speak about because we want to reserve those so when we get future reports, we can tell about them. There's missing evidence. The evidence, this is a cold case, and the evidence over the years that was gathered in one place is scattered about. The interpretations are a little bit foggy. I know that some of the work that I've already done with my model of the Phoenix Lights is not really accurate. I only determined a better sense of what went on when I actually talked to the witnesses personally. And I also believe that there's a tremendous amount of unreported evidence. My suspicion is you can't throw a rock in this town if you've got a good arm and not hit somebody that either saw something that night or knows someone that did. And my further suspicion is that that person hasn't ever said anything about it to anybody because of the nature of the event. And if we could get everyone who saw something to go to a website and put in a report anonymously and tell us exactly where they were standing and exactly what they saw from a menu list, or give them make their own description, we would have a much greater idea detail of what's went on. I think there's a lot of evidence that just isn't there. And I guess finally the last major key event is the idea that the Phoenix Lights, spectacular though they may be, they're just a part of something larger that's going on around this entire planet. I mean, there was a week before, there was a similar V-shaped craft sighted in St. Petersburg, Russia. And think about that for a moment. That takes away some of the possibility that this was a psychological operation run by the United States Air Force or DARPA or someone using some kind of hologram projection technology, that they wanted to run it from dreamland where they keep it in a hangar down through Phoenix just to see if anybody noticed, and then put it back and use it later for some battlefield purpose. That's a pretty credible theory, but it doesn't explain Hudson Valley, and it doesn't explain St. Petersburg, and it doesn't explain the triangle that went on in Belgium. So if anything, that the Phoenix Lights, the most important part of it is all the other reports that are like it that we don't talk about.
That's true. And I think, you know, what you were saying about, you know, we go to a reporting site and report. You know, that's something that we can't stress enough. I don't care where you're at on the planet. You see something that you can't identify, you need to do as good an observation as you possibly can, and if nothing else, write down details as soon as it's over and report it. It doesn't necessarily have to be the Phoenix Lights incident, or Tinley Park in Illinois, or Hudson Valley in New York, in Connecticut. If you see something, report it. You'd be surprised at how many people, once they find out, oh, well, somebody else saw this, then they feel more comfortable coming forward with what they saw.
And the more having one or more person report similar object in more or less similar space, if we could do some triangulation, if we could do some time correlation, we can understand a lot more. There is science to be done on UFO reports. However, you need to get them all in some kind of common context, and you need to get them in a timely fashion, and you need to sort them out from people who just want to make noises about having seen something. It's kind of saddening that YouTube has become such a playground for people who've gotten their hands on a high-end civilian rendering system or whatever, and decided to try it out by making a UFO appear in a otherwise normal scene. I saw a very funny video a little bit ago about a chase, and it was a cheetah running along chasing some hapless deer in Africa, and towards the end, a human runs through real fast and grabs the deer and picks it up and runs away. And this was obviously a little bit of video spoofing that was done, you know, probably in the course of a long weekend afternoon, and posted up there for the fun of it. We see a lot of video reports of UFOs that are the same way. They're just little bitty video pranks. The technology we've got at our hands and our disposal on the internet YouTube and all of the little cameras that are now in everybody's cell phones and in their pockets that can take video and stills. If we were to combine that with some training, and we were to combine that with an observation system, and people were to take the issue just somewhat seriously, just report what you saw, not have to face the stigma that somebody might laugh at you, and if we could then correlate those reports in real time and present the results back to the people who are also looking at the situation, we need to be able to react more or less in real time to these events. We could change the public's perception of the UFO situation in America in very short order if we can get a proper visualization and response system funded and in place.
Oh, I agree. I thoroughly agree. All the garbage, I guess you could call it, the fake stuff, the CGI that you see on places like YouTube, make this job so much more difficult and contribute to the giggle factor that, you know, it makes you wonder what's going through these people's head when they're doing stuff like that.
Well, they live in a paradigm where there really aren't aliens and all aliens are false and the only way to have an alien is to make one up, and now they've got a tool that lets them, and so they're having a good time. I don't know that they're that far off, but I don't think they recognize that they're kind of polluting the information space a little bit. And there are honest mistakes. I saw a video recently, Breathless Voice. Oh my God, I stepped out for a cigarette and I got a video of this thing. It was moving quickly. It didn't have flashing lights, so I wasn't an airliner, and I don't know what it was, and I zoomed in and all I got was this massive, gigantic orb. So I went off to take a look at the video, and when the camera zoomed back and held still for a little bit, and I could see enough of the surrounding terrain, it became apparent fairly quickly that what we were looking at was one of those rare passes that the International Space Station will make when it's still in sunlight and the observer is well into twilight in the afternoon. And it does a very steady, stately thing. It takes about 5 minutes to get from horizon to horizon. You should go to a website called heavensabove.org, I think it is. heavensabove-above.com. You might have to Google this. But there's a way to predict this. You go and put your latitude, longitude, your zip code, or whatever's in, and you can go find out when the circumstances are just right. You can see the space station go over, and it is a stunning sight. However, if you take a TV camera or a home video camera and you zoom in deeply and the camera can't focus on anything that far away, it autofocuses wide and the object appears to blur into a kind of a characteristic oval shape in the part of the optics of the way the system works. And if you don't know what you're looking at and you do all that and you're excited, it's easy to decide for a while you must be seeing something totally unusual and amazing. And in fact,
that's true. Like you said, the space, International Space Station, several years ago, I was watching TV news, and the weatherman come on and saying, oh, if you look up at such and such a time and go out and you'll see the space shuttle following... I think it was the Mir, station up there. And sure enough, you went out there at the time he said to go look, and you could see this bright light followed by another bright light going across the sky until they got to where the day-night terminator in the sky was, and no more sunlight hitting him, and they just kind of almost quickly wink out.
Oh my God, they winked out. They must have leapt into another dimension. It was here a minute ago. It was traveling across the sky. It didn't have navigation lights. All of a sudden, it was gone.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, that's what happens a lot of the times. And just knowing that that's what goes... I'm very proud of American space technology, and I always make a point to go look at the space station and go over every time I can. They've added a lot of solar cells in the last half dozen missions, and it can get, you know, much brighter than Venus. And then if it goes into the Earth's shadow, it just kind of seems to just suddenly disappear.
And then the one following it disappears.
Oh, no. Wow.
Yeah, and it made me wonder, standing there watching that, made me wonder, I didn't know whether any of the other stations, you know, were talking about it, but the one I was watching happened to, and I'm going, I wonder how many people who weren't watching the weather report didn't hear about this, and they're watching this and say, oh my God, there's a UFO up there.
It just disappeared. It must have done something magical to go to just wink out like that. Or actually, maybe we don't have to get so excited. Maybe it turned off its running lights. I don't know. But I think this and the research balloon that recently went over the valley points to the fact that we've got an awful lot of things that go on in the sky. To be perfectly honest with you, I took a field investigator report one time in Los Angeles by a fellow who was quite agitated that every night suddenly there was this new thing that was hovering outside his window, and we had to go investigate it, and when we got there, it honestly turned out to be Venus.
That happens quite a bit. And on that note, we need to go to a break.
Oh, very good.
And so we'll be back here on Eye to the Sky, the UFO synopsis on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network in about 8 or 9 minutes, and we'll continue this discussion.
Welcome to Eye to the Sky, the UFO synopsis. Now here's your host, DeAndrew.
And welcome to Eye to the Sky, the UFO synopsis here on Paranormal Radio Network, also broadcast live on UPRN 105.3 in New Orleans. I'm your host, DeAndrew, and tonight I've been talking with Larry Lowe. Larry, while we were talking during the break, you wanted to touch on the exopolitics end of ufology, and in particular, a piece of video work done by a very intelligent young man, and for life of me, I can't think of his name again. I don't have it written down, darn it. That pretty much sums up exopolitics in just that nice, short, little brief video.
Yes, I would. I wrote, in fact, a piece that I've got at the Examiner, Phoenix UFO Examiner now, and if anyone's going on the web, you simply go examiner.com, and then you go down to Gadgets and Tech. Then inside there, if you're in Phoenix in particular, you sort of automatically get it. I should be up on one of the recent postings. I've currently put up a piece on some rare film, an analysis of some rare film of a George Adamski saucer. But the prior article was a piece that I did called Disclosure 101. And Disclosure 101 was really a wrapping a frame around a very elegant little painting. And that painting was a film that was made by a budding young filmmaker whose name is Jake Gould. And Jake Gould was schooled in London, currently lives in Hong Kong, and had the kind of the serendipitous opportunity to be amongst kind of the movers and the shakers of the exopolitics disclosure movement. And being a resourceful filmmaker, and he only had just a camera and the opportunity to talk to these people, he commandeered a hotel room, sat these folks down, and asked them a series of very straightforward questions. What is disclosure? spectacular job. I mean, when the history's written, and I don't think Steve Bass is at least concerned about this aspect of it, but when the history is written of man's shift through this paradigm of they're not to here to they are here, he's going to be remembered as one of the guys that helped make it happen with the X conference in 2000, well, for some number of years now, his Million Facts March on Washington, his relentless efforts to educate the media, educate the public, and agitate for movement with the political powers that be to simply disclose the fact that there's extraterrestrial I don't even think the extraterrestrial hypothesis is the correct one, but I don't want to digress. There's non-human entities operating advanced technology inside our biosphere, has been for well over 50 years. Evidence of that is rampant. And why don't we come to our senses and admit it? There's lots of reasons, of course. So Steve Bassett's trying to run the disclosure movement. Michael Sala is running the exopolitics movement. Rebecca Hardcastle is trying to run the, she's developing the whole concept of exoconsciousness. And Jake Gould set these people down in a very nice little sparse setting with not a lot of theatrical exuberance and made a video that he posted on YouTube that has gone now well past 5,000 hits. I mean, I've got a graph on it at Tracker. And it just let everybody say in clear and simple terms what the issues are, how important this is, and why we should care and what we should do about it. And it is this interesting little piece of recursive Web 2.0 semantic video, because it's just the kind of viral thing that can really catch fire. And I would encourage everybody that is listening to this, including all my good friends down in New Orleans. I've got fond memories of the 1984 World's Fair and eating crawdads off the back end of a pickup truck. Anyway, I would encourage everybody to go to my examiner.com, read the piece, watch the video, and then follow the short list of directions at the bottom of the piece. Email the URL of the video to your friends. Add it to your Facebook page. Spread the word around. If these concepts are new to you, do your homework. There's requested reading there. Jeff Peckman is in there. If there's an opportunity to talk to the media in your town, do so. If there's an opportunity to go to the extracampaign.org website, press the little button, just like Jeff Peckman says, and start a ballot initiative in your town, do so. I think we're going to find, as the summer ensues, that the ballot initiative, the user-generated public access lawmaking procedure, is going to become very important and very visible. And everybody can do this. I think we've all felt for a long time that shucks, there's nothing we can do. I kind of know they're here. Uncle Fred saw one back in the 50s. I remember that. I know about it, but it's. I can't talk about it. I can't do anything about it. Well, now you can. And Jake Gould has given us this marvelous gift of this eloquent little film that if we just pass it around, if everybody would take the URL and pass it around and make sure it's popular, I think it would put a very good foot forward for the whole movement of admitting to ourselves as a society that there's more going on here than we would like to, that the normal media would like to have us believe.
I agree with you. He did a wonderful piece of work with that video. I have a question from one of the members in our virtual auditorium, November Hansen, who hosts Voice of the People right after this program, would like to know, who do you think will participate first? undeniable disclosure.
Are we talking about which nation?
Yes, I guess. You know, who, whether it be ET, U.S. government, another country government, who do you think will be the first one to disclose?
Well, I think to answer the question in the spirit that it was asked, I'd have to kind of say I'm not sure. The drumbeat underneath the ground, the Coconut Telegraph, tells us that Stephen Greer has gotten a what he refers to as a major G7 or G8 country all ready to go on this thing. And I've got to note with some disdain or despair that England released their UFO files here recently. France led the way earlier. Canada's done some. Brazil's done some. Japan is very open about the issue. A lot of the countries around the world, in fact, almost all of them, seem to be a lot more open to the whole set of issues than America. We seem to be pulling up the last of the wagon train for some reason. And so on one hand, you'd love it to be America because we need to lead in this area, but I'm a little concerned that the political environment won't let it be. Will the ET finally decide that enough is enough and just do some sort of dramatic event that will be unquestionable? Well, you could argue they did that on March 13th, 1997, and people are still arguing. I make the analogy like if a stranger comes up to your door and knocks on it, says, "Hello, anybody home?" If you don't open up the door and say, "Hi, who are you?" you can't get a conversation going. And it's almost as if there's been undeniable events. But I don't think that the ETs, whom, however many different kinds there are, whatever their motivation may be, want to break the psychological shock absorber that we've all got. So I would tend to say they wouldn't do it, and that would sort of leave possibly another major country might actually pull the Trump card of all history and say, we're going to acknowledge the presence of extraterrestrial life or non-human life inside our biosphere. I would just add as a slight comment. So I think that the real issue of disclosure is a private one. And I think it really has to go from the grassroots up. And this is sort of where Peckman is going and where I'm going with my interactive network and what I call Disclosure 2.0. Disclosure 2.0 is a private viral process that works throughout the internet of everybody making it okay to talk to one another about these issues and getting rid of the giggle factor within the little society of the people you know. And then they talk to the people they know. And then they talk to the people they know. And they use Facebook and they use MySpace and they use YouTube. And eventually, everyone realizes, well, we all knew this all along. And disclosure has happened without anybody disclosing anything, and at that point, certainly whoever's in the office at the time can stand up and say, well, I guess you all know they're here and have been for some time, and they won't risk any political capital. So, I don't know. I guess if I had to make a guess, you know, it might be France. Would be the country that would do it first. They kind of were the first ones to come out with the Comita report. But it's anyone's guess, and it's everyone's responsibility.
I know a lot of people who feel that it would be ET that actually finally comes forward and say, hey, we're here. You know, I'm almost of an opinion of that now. God, and I hate the term contactee because of the connotations of the contactee movement of the 50s and the 60s, where we had all kinds of you know, oddballs coming out of the woodwork. Yeah, well, I was trying to be polite about it. But, you know, and abductee, yeah, I guess you could use that term because they were taken against their will. But
well,
the early
contactees were actually not taken against their will. There was, we see whole genres of activity go on. And I've got a piece up at Phoenix UFO Examiner right now about George Adamski, who was kind of the pioneer contactee of the time. Most of those guys tended to be ridiculous at the end of the day, and so they were ridiculed, and that kind of started the thing. But there's a particular piece of film that he shot that it turns out it's undergone some fairly sophisticated analysis, and it appears to be exactly what it says it is. And if that's the case, then there's some real fire where all that smoke of the contactee movement was.
True.
But
a lot of I like to refer to them as experiencers.
Yes.
A lot of these people who are experiencers, to me, in my own head, is open contact. You know, saying we're here, but unfortunately, a large portion of the population's not believing them.
Well, here's a very interesting piece of food for thought for you. And I hope I'm not going to get too esoteric, but I had a conversation with John Alexander here the other day, and he made a very interesting point. He's associated with National Institute for Discovery Science and a pretty heavy-duty scientific individual. But he's also examining consciousness at some interesting level to begin to kind of get the correlation between consciousness and one's perception of reality and the UFO problem. And he said to me that, and I'm going to paraphrase these, this is not his exact words, but when you start talking about experiences out of the normal realm of Western scientific reductionist mindset, what I call the box of context in which acceptable phenomena are contained and unacceptable phenomena are excluded. When you start talking about these kinds of things that are outside the box of context, he says 80% of the average American respondent will tell you that they believe or understand or will give credence to that sort of experience because they've got some actual experience in that phenomenon, or they know somebody in the family who did. And I'm talking about precognition, telepathy, knowing who's on the phone when it rings, perceptions of things like UFOs, spirits, telekinesis, whatever. Anything outside the box, and I think all of these things, by the way, are related at some level. 80% of America tends to believe one or more of those and give some credence. On the other hand, if you narrow the survey down to the highly trained, degreed, totally focused scientific minds who are the ones that are peer-reviewing each other's papers, the ones who are the gateways and alleged gatekeepers of our understanding, only 4% of them can acknowledge these kinds of things because they have any kind of personal experience or any willingness to look into it. And so when you say we don't get it, I think there's a big misnomer there. I think we get it. I think the people that drive the outward appearance of our society, the scientific, the academic community, and by following on, the media and the political communities, they don't want to touch this, and they will not accept it, and they can't accept it because they haven't got any experience. But we, in large part, I think we're ready.
Oh, I agree with that. I think with all the, well, like UFO hunters on History Channel and the three pieces that Brian Gumble did for Sci-Fi Channel and all these UFO documentaries that are out there, such as Out of the Blue, Fast Walkers, and all these others, that it's not only educating the public and making them aware of the subject, but it's also helping to prepare people for disclosure.
There are people whose paradigm hasn't yet shifted, and to the extent that they've got a firm grip on what they think reality is, they're going to have a problem of some sort dealing with the issue. Alexander also told me the results of a study that he and his wife did at NIDS about religious, highly religious people. I don't have the details at my fingertips as I should, but they polled, I think, 1,200 religious leaders. They got a 23% return, which was a good return rate. And by and large, the response was, if E.T. turned out to be real tomorrow, it would be no big deal to the religious community. They could deal with it. Some of them just thought, oh, that would be great. We'd have more people we could get into the congregation. I think a lot of the trumped-up excuses for why there is not an open appreciation and understanding of the evidence and the reports and the implications of that is not what we're being told or assumed. I don't think the religious issue is a big issue. I don't think there's going to be a panic, as everyone says there would be with Orson Welles. I think we've got a small number of people in key positions in society who have not opened up their mind to the process, and they seem to be kind of sitting at the gate of open acknowledgement. In fact, I've really got a problem with the word disclosure. I think the more proper word is acknowledgement. Go to MUFON's website and do a search for the local reports, or Brian Vike's site in Canada, or Peter Davenport's site in Seattle, and just go search the reports for UFO observation on any given day, any given week, any given month. There's so much going on that doesn't need to be disclosed. It needs to be acknowledged.
I agree. You make a good point, a very good point. I have a question in here that David has been bugging me to ask Jeff. And he would like to know, with you being a former commercial pilot, how many sightings by airline pilots do you think don't get reported each year?
Lots.
Yourself included?
So many that we don't know. I won't speak to that issue.
Okay.
We had a. I recently filmed a video segment for a major cable television network, where we conducted, I think, a fairly thoughtful investigation of UFOs with the Phoenix Lights as a focal point, and we had one airline pilot who has come out in the past, whose name is well known, and who in fact spoke at the MUFON Phoenix meeting, which is, let's see, second Saturday of every month. Once again, everyone should, in the Phoenix area at least, should go to MUFON Phoenix and check them out, because they're doing a great job. He spoke at the MUFON meeting, but he would not appear in our video segment because he likes to keep his pension working even though he's retired. We had an active duty pilot who refused to even get near the set, be associated with it, identify, because he was still flying. And both of these guys saw the Phoenix Lights craft objects up close and personal, had a good look at them, had an amazing story to tell. Their data points would add to our understanding of the problem, and both of them refused to participate in what I think was probably going to be one of the more credible, more thoughtful video presentations of this phenomenon that I've ever seen. And this all stems from an incident in with a Japanese 747 pilot that was flying from France to Japan. Somewhere over Alaska, he was paced by an object that, I don't know, was 5 or 6 times the size of his 747. And he reported it when he landed at Fairbanks, or Anchorage, I guess it was Anchorage. And he was fired for making the report.
Oh, wow.
So how many airline pilots are there that have seen things that haven't talked about it? We're never going to know, because they're surely not going to talk about it. And they're not going to talk about it because of that same kind of societal denial, only it's even worse than a ridicule factor. They're risking their livelihood if they talk about it. I had an individual write me after my first Examiner article who I'm simply going to say was in a position to know what the United States Air Force military response was on the night of March 13th. And he said they were really concerned because there were things going on in the sky that they did not understand, and they were sending fighters out after them, and fighters were coming back with gun camera film. They couldn't, you know, understand what it was. Radar reports that didn't make sense, and unbelievable performance. And there was a real anxiety going on. He talked with me a little bit. Let me say this correctly. He communicated with me for a brief period of time in private on a back channel, and I was trying to nurture him as a source, but I made a stupid blunder by needing to know a little bit more than I needed to know. And he just said, I don't want to talk to anybody that's going to ask me too many of the wrong kinds of questions. And that source has since dried up. So the real font of information, the pilots, their traffic controllers, doctors, psychiatrists. Can you imagine a psychiatrist having a UFO observation and then having to think about filing a report?
Okay.
I mean, they don't want to be judged as a little bit screwy, do they?
No.
Lost
no,
track
not
of
at
reality.
All.
Yeah, right. That might reflect upon their livelihood. So, all kinds of or disciplines, quality people have got quality sightings that we never hear about.
And that's unfortunate. You know, unless they get brave enough to report it to NARCAP, which is the International Reporting Center. No, actually, NARCAP only deals with the United States, rather, excuse me. But NARCAP is a reporting center where pilots, be they commercial, military, private pilot, whatever, can report sightings without their names being associated with the subject. And NARCAP is the National Aviation Reporting Center on Anomalous Phenomenon. And
would that be Fred Haynes?
Yes.
Dr. Haynes.
And Ted Rowe? Or
yes.
Richard Haynes.
Richard Haynes. Thank you very much. Richard Haynes. He's long been the champion of the airline pilot.
Exactly.
The problem is, and I shouldn't say that there's a problem. The concern is that organizations like his gather this data, and we don't get to see it very much. I've seen some of the reports that Richard Haynes has put together. They're compelling. There just isn't any other way around it. But we need to find a way to get that information assembled and on display and out in public where everyone can take advantage of it. Part of that means we need to have the curiosity on the part of the general population to go look for it. Frankly, UFO hunters is as good a place as any. You know, if it takes the History Channel or the Discovery Channel, or some other television channel that's got the nerve to put together a sensibly hosted, thoughtful, steady discussion of what's going on. That's how these sources of information are going to come out.
And unfortunately, I found out last night that UFO hunters will not be back for another season, which has got me very disappointed. I think they were doing an excellent job.
They had quite a run at it, and they took on a lot of cases.
Oh, didn't they though? I thought they did a wonderful job, especially on the Tinley Park in Illinois sighting. And several others. Another aspect that you've been looking into that I think is a fascinating area is shamanism and ufology. I understand the connection, but I don't think a lot of my audience would.
Well, if they don't, I mean, I'm wondering how many eyeballs are beginning to roll around out there in UFO land when I start talking about shamanism. It speaks to a higher order understanding of what may be going on. I think at the end of the day, we've got to just back way off and say, okay, we have a big mystery here. There's things appearing and disappearing and doing things that defy all kinds of sensibilities. And they exhibit what I think it was Jacques Vallée coined the term high strangeness. There's a certain set of reports where things are just simply too unusual to categorize. And then there are similar aspects of this. George Knapp was one of the investigators that investigated the Skinwalker Ranch. They went up there and they were, a lot of odd behavior was going on. There was a one point during the night, they had a night scope looking in an area, and what appeared to be a portal of some sort opened up, and something just crawled right out of it and started wandering around. And there were things appeared inside locked rooms. A whole steer ended up in a room that wasn't there, that couldn't have gotten in. It was locked from the inside, and the steer had been missing from a field earlier. There's a report of a Bigfoot I heard recently where it was running right past somebody and it simply ran into thin air and disappeared. So there's a whole, to take this to the Phoenix Lights, there's a level of, or a set of reports at a place called Crown King, which everybody here in Arizona knows about. It says you're coming down from Flagstaff. There's a little rest stop just before you go down off the top of the Mogollon Rim into the valley. And that night, in daylight, there were three large V-shaped craft hovering around, appeared under mysterious circumstances. And in short order, jets were heard. This was observed by, I think, 8 or 10 witnesses. I can't remember the detail. But the reports was that the three wings then aligned themselves so they were directly above and below each other, and they collapsed into a heap, into one, and it shrank to a ball of light, and it winked out. These craft didn't take off and go anywhere. They winked out of existence. Well, when you start talking about the kinds of experiences where people find themselves taken out of their bodies at night and drifted through walls and up into craft and circumstances, and they are observed and shown things and taught things and various procedures, and then they're returned back to their bed and their mates are not disturbed, there becomes a line with all these high strangeness reports where you be, begin to wonder, is it a matter of the perception of the observer that's part of the process? And I begin to wonder about this when I see reports of a couple of people nearby one another. One of them sees the object and reports it and says there's a flying saucer right out there in front of me. And the one nearby, or maybe riding in the same car, says, I don't see it. I don't understand what you're talking about. And if it's perception that is part of what makes the UFO phenomenon so elusive and so intractable, then maybe what's going on as we move forward is advanced forms of perception are what's required. And when you begin to look at the intriguing and powerful information that has been passed down to among themselves, among the indigenous Native Americans, the Inca, the Mayans, the folks who in Iquitos, Peru, who find a way to get to a different level of perception with their consciousness and begin to report activities and creatures and behaviors that are outside our paradigm, and consistently report them when they go into these conditions and states. Maybe you begin to get to the idea that not only do we have to sort of understand how the UFO might fit inside our reality, but we need to understand how to expand our perception of reality to include these subtle and yet highly powerful modes of perception that the shaman, the medicine man, the yogi, the Tibetan Buddhist monk, the yogi in India who can appear to be in two places at once, the Sioux tribal medicine man who claims that when he gets into his state, he can detach from his body and travel not amongst the trees and not amongst the clouds, but amongst the stars, and in fact will go to the center of what the white man calls the Milky Way. It may even be that if you're going to exceed the speed of light, this is all hypothetical, but I'm just as a point here, if you're going to exceed the speed of light and solve the transportation problem, maybe at that speed, something to do with E equals MC squared is such that your matter turns into energy for the moment of the transition, and you wink back on someplace else across the galaxy. And to make that kind of travel, perhaps your consciousness has to be well enough formed that it can withstand that kind of transition. So studying the shamanistic knowledge that's been passed down has begun to become a very important part of what I'm trying to do to understand what we're faced with. And it's difficult to, how do I want to put this? I'm trying to maintain a scientific, analytical, nuts and bolts, show me the results on a graph somewhere analysis so that we can sort out the weather balloons and the space stations and the reflections of lights on fog from the actual unknown events. But I think there comes a point where we've really got to investigate the realms of the mind and the realms of the energy state, which leads to spiritual techniques and understanding, if we're going to understand how some of these strange things actually go on.
Actually, that makes good sense to me.
Oh, good.
when you listen to some of the Native American traditional stories, like, for example, Gary A. David did a wonderful book, and for life of me, I can't think of the name of it right at the moment. David will probably tell me. Gary A. David's book was talking about, it was an Orion connection.
The Orion Man.
Yeah. Pardon?
The Orion Mystery, I believe.
I think that's it. And he tells the story of the ant people, that the local Indian tribes in Arizona, because that's where he's from, is here in Arizona, and how their description almost fits, the descriptions of the ant people almost fit perfectly with the stereotypical grays. Yeah,
And what did the ant people do?
They saved people from a disaster.
Exactly. They preserved the civilization. They took them underground, and all kinds of stuff went on the surface, and then they came back up from underground and continued to go on, and is that the Hopi?
I think so.
Yeah.
In his book, he also tells of how, if you connect the dots, so to speak, of the different larger communities, I guess you could say, of the Native Americans then, such as Wapaki and Montezuma's Castle and all those other places, they form the same outline as the constellation Orion, which
as,
I always
as,
thought was
as does the a number of monuments in Egypt, including the three pyramids of Giza. There's that same
and
pattern.
Several,
yeah, as above, so below.
Exactly, and a lot of other ancient sites do that as well in different countries.
Let me give you a close to home one more bit of it. That's sort of there for the putting together. It's not terribly hard. One of the salient aspects of the Phoenix Lights phenomenon are these large lights that are referred to as orbs that are spherical. There's a kind of a bound to the light. They're much bigger than any kind of typical light. They hover silently in position. They don't have any craft associated with them. You see them in ones and twos and fives and sevens. And we see them today. I mean, one of the things we've got to underscore with the Phoenix Lights is it's going on today. It was going on well before the March 1997. And in particular, these orbs hang there almost like balls of energy with a kind of a bit of a definition to them. And they have been seen in the area of the Estrella Mountains forever, and reports of them go back to the tribes, the Pima, the Indians that live south of the Estrella Mountains, refer to them all the time in their literature. And the book I'm reading that was just given to me by some good friends, Fool's Crow, Wisdom and Power, he talks about how he speaks to balls of light in his shamanic state. And the Estrellas, which I can never pronounce right, the name of that is because it refers to the Star Mountains. And so the Indians think of the star people. And they think in terms of dealing with a ball of light. And they talk, they can communicate with them. And one almost gets the idea that the amber orbs that populate the Phoenix Valley are what I would call an unacknowledged natural phenomenon. I don't know how many people have told me, oh yeah, I see them every once in a while. They're out there. They show up, they hang around for a while and go away. You see them over the superstitions, and you see them on the other side of the Estrellas, and you see them Moon Valley. And they're not that frequent, but they're not that unusual. And maybe they're a part of the natural environment somehow that we just don't quite have we don't have the skills. We weren't taught the skills the way the Native Americans teach their children. We haven't put the time in to be a medicine man. Consequently, it ends up being an unknown.
Interesting. You know, unfortunately, we've got like 3 minutes left, and I still haven't gotten all I wanted in yet.
Well, let me take one moment of that time, because as I said, I'm just getting back into all of this after a few years, and I'm being given an opportunity here somehow to use the Phoenix Lights as a mechanism to do something. And a lot of people have been willing to help me along the way and provide me with support or energy or information or a contact or whatever it took at the moment. And I just need to thank everyone, who's some of which don't want to be named, and the rest pretty well know who they are. But it is a privilege to be able to do this work, and it's something very interesting is coming up here soon. Don't you feel that? Don't you think we're gathering momentum somehow?
Yeah. Yeah, I do. Oh, gosh, let's see. We've got just a little less than 3 minutes. Gosh, let's see. I did kind of want to touch on Paul Van Ward, but I don't know if we're going to have any time to.
Very briefly. Pardon? Paul Van Ward wrote a great book called God's Genes and Consciousness, and I guess I would recommend that as reading to anybody who's listening to anything I've had to say tonight that fired a neuron, made him wonder about it. I would just say go read his book. That's all we need to do.
Okay. And personally, I'm going to see if I can't find a copy of that as well. It sounds like an intriguing book. I guess I just go on to my final question, see if we can't get it in 2 minutes. What can the average person do?
Well, I think the average person can educate themselves if they're not. I think the average person can spread the word. If you ask some people, they will tell you that Facebook elected the sitting president of the United States of America. And by that, they mean the social phenomenon of people working together in small groups. And I think that 80% of the people who already understand there's a lot more going on than we're being told officially needs to get together and realize that the other 80% is just like them, their neighbors, their society. You can go to extracampaign.org, Jeff Peckman's website, fire up a petition in your town, an initiative, a ballot initiative for disclosure. You can support Stephen Bassett's group. Donate some money to the Paradigm Research Group and let him continue to do his good work. Read the Examiner. And pass it along to your friends. Get a copy of Disclosure 101. Share it. Get everybody into the living room one night, your friends in the neighborhood. Show the movie on your TV and discuss it. I think that everybody can do this at a personal level, and I think that's what it's going to take.
Very well said. Very, very well said. And we're real close to out of time. If you want to get in your websites real quick.
Well, I am the Phoenix Examiner, Phoenix UFO Examiner at examiner.com. Lynn Katai's gracefully let us put the animation project at gap.thephoenixlights.net, but I would warn everybody that's a development version. And of course, my website is LarryLowe.com, but I'm not really, haven't got it too spruced up yet. I'm still building my infrastructure. So gap.phoenixlights.net and examiner.com. Come read the Phoenix Examiner, UFO Examiner, and there'll be more there.
And we'll have those websites up on the Eye to the Sky website as well. That way people can go there and find them, because I hadn't been putting out the Ostadio an animation thing you've got going out.
It is really in development. It's not really ready for public consumption, so we'll just only mention it as far as we have, but it will be soon. I guess watching The Examiner is the best way to take a look at it now. And there's some exciting new potentials. I'm talking to some people about some opportunities, which I think are hugely exciting, but they don't bear going into at the moment.
Okay, and unfortunately, we are all out of time. In fact, we went over a little bit. And that's all we have for tonight. I'm sorry, I wish I could go longer. But I want to thank everyone for tuning in, and also thank those who joined us here in Pal Talk, and to thank Larry again for joining us. Stay tuned for Voice of the People, hosted by November Hansen. Our guests tonight will be Paul Davis and Edward P. Martin. And please join us again next Saturday on UFO Paranormal Radio Network for another episode of Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, where my guest will be Greg Bishop. Until then, keep an eye to the sky. Good night, everyone.